Let's open our Bibles to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13, and this morning we'll be looking at verses 11 through 14. Yes, we will make it through more than one verse, the Lord willing. Hebrews 13. It hurts to be excluded from the insiders. None of us like being shunned by the group. And you know what I'm talking about, where we experienced it typically as young people, but we can still experience it today and oftentimes do. We want to belong. We want to fit in. We want to be accepted. You think about that young person who sees a group of kids. They're having a great time, and they're looking longingly and painfully at that group, wishing that they could be accepted by that group and to belong. Do you ever feel pressure from others that their church, the way that they express it, their church is the in church? Now, everybody should be excited about their church. They should, you know, in their heart, wish everybody would go there if it's a good, sound, biblical church. But I'm talking about those people that make you feel like if you don't go to their church, you're missing something. You're missing out. Maybe you're missing out on the liturgy, the, you know, traditional elements that, as we look back in church history and even Jewish history, that were present. A new music style, a new worship style, a place that's hip and cool, the place that today everybody wants to be. Our Savior felt that religious pressure. Do you remember how he was pressured to fit into the religion of his day? That Judaism was, in the land of Israel, was it. I mean, that was the religion. Now, granted, they had missed the mark somewhat. They had drifted from true biblical Judaism, from the true Old Covenant religion. But they tried to pressure him into going along with the status quo, and actually they expected him to support the status quo. They wanted him to toe the party line. But as he taught, new wine can't be put into old wineskins, at least not without a disaster. And so Jesus brought a religion that saves, not a religion that may have promised salvation through works but couldn't deliver. Like John the Baptist, the old covenant prepared the way for the new covenant, and then it got out of the way. That's how it worked in God's view, but people didn't want to let go. They wanted to hold on to that old covenant. I mean, their people had followed that for so long, centuries, and now they're asked to turn loose of that. And so Jesus was rejected by the old covenant insiders. Now, I want to mention to you and encourage you in this. Don't ever think of Jesus' rejection by Israel to be an oops, that God had to scramble to, like, oh, I didn't see that coming. Or some people would say, well, you know, he saw it coming, but it was kind of like, okay, when he looked, you know, at human history, he's like, they're going to, right here at this point in history, they're going to reject my son. So, okay, what am I going to do about that? Oftentimes I hear theologians talking that way, as if it was, you know, that God is kind of, you know, reacting. We need to remember that Jesus being rejected was the plan. It was the plan all along. And just like Jesus, guess what? Rejection is the plan for us. That's what we are to expect. And actually, as the writer here is going to encourage us, and as Paul in his ministry has exemplified in his own life, we're to actually carry that reproach of Christ with us. We're called as priests, believer priests, to minister outside of unbiblical religion. And just like with Jesus, it may be people very close to us, even within our religious circles, who reproach us for our religion, for the way that we, you know, you say do church, you know, what we do here and what we believe. To the old ways, we are a departure from tradition, and to modern ideas, we are seen as out of date. It's kind of funny. This depends on who's looking at us. As to one thinks that we're not old-fashioned enough, and the other thinks we're too old-fashioned. So, this can affect the way or where we choose to fellowship. And if we feel that pressure for so long, we may finally say, you know, I need to go, you know, back to, you know, the old days where there was more liturgy and tradition. Or we may say, you know, I need to get hip with the new ideas. And it may affect us then. And it may also affect the boldness with which we serve. As our brother was talking about, we want to take the gospel out to people, to more and more people in our community. But do we find ourselves saying, you know, our church isn't this or this, and so I don't feel comfortable, you know, inviting them to our church because it's not the old ways that are long respected tradition or the new ways. So it can affect our boldness to serve. Are we willing to suffer reproach for Christ's sake, even at the hands of others within Christendom? Well, let's look at Hebrews chapter 13, and I want to back up to verse 7 and read there. Hebrews 13, beginning in verse 7, the writer says, "Remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Do not be carried away by varied and strange teachings. For it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, through which those who were thus occupied were not benefited," talking about the Old Testament priests when they offered sacrifices. "We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of lips that give thanks to his name. And do not neglect doing good and sharing, for with such sacrifices God is pleased." Think about the similarities between the readers of this letter to the Hebrews, these Jewish Christians, similarities between them and us here at JBC, Christians in our day. If you look back, some of the things that plagued them, these ideas that pulled on them. For one, they were very strongly pulled back toward Judaism. A lot of the people had already gone back to Judaism because it was something that was long respected in their circles. It had been around, tried and true over the centuries. Why not come back? You know, you tried this Jesus thing for a while, and look what it got you. People took away your stuff. They threw you in prison. They persecuted you. They're probably going to persecute you again. So come back where it's stable, it's secure. We today suffer similar things. I mean, there are people who want to pull us back, we being Protestants, to pull us back to the old, what they would say is, you know, come back to the church. You know, and talking about the Roman church, Roman Catholic church, they want to pull us back. And you know, what's interesting is Roman Catholicism is largely built upon the same misunderstanding of the old covenant that the old Judaism was built on. I'm not talking about biblical Judaism. I'm talking about unbiblical Judaism that Jesus and the apostles fought against and taught against. And so that same thing can pull. I mean, we've gone through, there's different waves if you kind of keep up with modern church history even. I remember back in the 80s, it was kind of all the rage. As one book said, you know, evangelicals on the Canterbury Trail. They're going back to, you know, Episcopalianism and Catholicism and things like that. You see, they're going back in that direction. And so we still struggle with that pull to those traditional elements. These readers we saw back in verse 9 were pulled in another way too. There were a lot of new ideas. Now, some of those new ideas, what would happen is, okay, we have Christianity here, and we don't really like this part, so let's take that out. And I liked what we used to do in Judaism, so let's pull a couple of those things in here. And then, the Greeks and Romans, they've got some pretty cool ideas. Man, we love what they do. So let's pull some of that in here too. And so they would mix that up and then serve up this new idea. So on the one hand, you have this desire for a revival of what Jesus actually put an end to, the old, and now a pull to the new, to take up these new ideas. And you know, what's interesting is pagan worship is built upon features that fallen mankind like. You know, it always scares me today. I remember when I was in seminary, the office I worked for the seminary for a while, and the office that I was in was next to another office, and I won't mention who it is because I don't want to speak ill of them here, you know, for everybody in the world to hear. But I was at the printer and I saw some things that were coming off for them. And it was just like, I was watching this. And I was like, interesting, you know, and then talking to them afterward, they were buying into this seeker friendly idea that, and they wanted to promote that at the seminary. And the idea was, let's go out to the people and ask them what they want. What do you want in a church? What could church do for you? And that scares me, because biblical religion doesn't go ask people what they want because they don't know. Now, they think they know, but their hearts are wicked and deceived. God doesn't ask people, what do you need? We would get it wrong every time. That's a test we would flunk every single time. Because why? In our fallen nature, we're nothing but narcissists and hedonists. What's in it for me? And so paganism is so good at being able to survey people and poll people and to find out, okay, what is it that you know, what can religion do for you? And that's how so many churches today are being built. They go out and they make a bit, they write books on it. This is how you go and you survey the populace and then build a church around that. And that's what was happening back in the New Testament time. It didn't take, you know, 2,000 years to get there. This was happening early on. I mean, this letter was written 30-ish years after Jesus. And there were people already peddling new ideas. And we knew that it was even much earlier than that, right? You read Acts. So this passage does have a lot to say to us this morning. First, Jesus, our new covenant sacrifice, suffered outside of the old covenant camp. It's kind of long. Let me repeat it. This is verses 11 and 12. Jesus, our new covenant sacrifice, suffered outside the old covenant camp. Look at verse 11. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. So what our author's doing here is he's transitioning from this general idea in verses 9 and 10 about sacrifices in general and whether or not we can eat of the priests could eat of those sacrifices, to the Day of Atonement specifically. And he's going to draw some parallels and contrasts with that Day of Atonement as he compares it with and contrasts it with Jesus. Now, sin offerings, one of the old covenant principles, was that sin offerings were off limits, even to the priests, to eat. You know how we talked about this last time. There were many of the sacrifices, that was how God provided for the priests. And so he said, priests, you can take a portion of these sacrifices. You know, we had, okay, this part, you know, you burn on the altar. That's God's part. And then the rest you can have. And you can take it home to your family. But then we saw that there were some sacrifices that only the priests were allowed to eat. And they had to stay right there in the courtyard of the tabernacle and eat it right there. They weren't allowed to share it with their families. But the Day of Atonement sacrifices and other sin, sacrifices for sin, not even the priests were allowed to eat. No one was. And so he reminds these Jewish readers that, remember that, every year, the Day of Atonement, when we're done with the sacrifices, take their carcasses outside the camp and burn them. You see, in the wilderness, when the Israelites came out of Egypt and they're in the wilderness, the camp, you know, where all their tents were set up and you had the tabernacle and everything, that was considered holy, sacred. Anything outside of that is where it's a place of shame. That's where you discard things like carcasses that you're done with. That's where you execute criminals, out in the place of shame. And then later, once the people got into the land and settled it, and then Jerusalem kind of became the hub, the capital city and all, and that's where the temple would be. Then Jerusalem itself, the city, was considered like the camp. It was like that wilderness camp. And anything outside of the city was considered, in that sense, unholy, unclean, a place of shame. So if you're going to execute somebody, you have to do it outside. If you're going to burn carcasses, you do it outside the city. And so on the Day of Atonement, you know, you remember he had those two goats. One of them, they would symbolically place their sins on that goat and let him go out into the wilderness. And then there was the other goat who died, and his blood was needed to offer in the Holy of Holies along with the blood of a bull. And so the blood, the bull and the goat that died, after they gave up their blood, we're done with it. We don't need those carcasses anymore, and we're not allowed to eat it, so we take it outside the city and burn them. But those were pictures of something that was going to happen. See, God, as he's laying out, this is what religion is going to be like, and he sets up the old covenant. He says, okay, this old covenant is actually going to be a picture, or a lot of pictures, of the new covenant. And there's going to be this one new covenant sacrifice. And this sacrifice, the Lamb of God, is going to die outside the camp. And so he laid out this in light of what's coming. And he says, okay, because Jesus is going to die outside the gate, carry those bodies outside the gate and burn them. So, and if you will, the pictures every year were burned outside the gate, pointing to the greater sacrifice that would come. Now look again at verse 12. Therefore, just like those sacrifices, those pictures, therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. God had determined that when it was time for the new covenant to come into play, to be started, that would be also the time when the old covenant was done. And so now that Jesus had come in the fullness of time, it was time for the old covenant sacrifices to stop. And so Jesus suffered outside the gate, outside of the temple. And keep this in mind. I think sometimes we get a little confused on it because we read passages that tell us that Jesus fulfilled the law, the old covenant. He fulfilled it. But have you realized this? Jesus' sacrifice was not an old covenant sacrifice. If it was, he would have had to die on the altar in the temple. And he didn't. Actually, it would be forbidden for Jesus to be killed there. See, the old covenant wouldn't allow the sacrifice of Christ. Jesus fulfilled the law. He kept it perfectly. But his sacrifice was a new covenant sacrifice. It was unique, at least a couple ways. One, it was unique in that it was the ultimate sacrifice. It would remove the need for any more sacrifices. It's so wrong for anyone to think of the Lord's table as a repeating of the sacrifice of Christ. There's that one sacrifice, once for all, it's done, don't ever repeat it. It's unique in that regard. It's also unique in that Jesus' body wasn't burned, was it? So there is a bit of a parallel between those carcasses that were burned, taken outside the camp and burned, because they foreshadowed Christ dying outside the city. But the similarity stops there. Jesus' body wasn't burned. Why? Well, he's going to need it in 3 days, right? After he dies? Because he's going to rise again. So we're not going to burn it. But unlike those old covenant sacrifices, that bull and that goat, as soon as they give up their blood, we didn't need them anymore. Their usefulness had expired. But the usefulness of Jesus' body did not expire. Think about verse 10. It talked about, we have an altar from which they do not have a right to eat, the Old Testament priests. We would continue to feed forever, will continue to feed forever on Jesus' body. We talked about that last time. It's by faith, right? But you see, he continually provides us with grace as we go to him by faith and we feed upon his sacrifice. These are just pictures of what we do by faith as we take the bread and drink the cup. We're just reminding ourselves that this is something we're supposed to do every day by faith, that is to feed upon Christ, upon Jesus' body and his blood. As we saw last time in John 6, he says, if you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you don't have any part with me. And throughout that passage, he talks about it is believing. These are pictures of believing, pictures of faith. So how much better is his sacrifice? Because his sacrifice is something we feed on every day, all day, by faith. See, he wasn't like those animals where his usefulness, the body, was no longer useful. Our author has already told us that the new covenant is not like the old covenant, quoting from Jeremiah. You see, keep in mind, okay, you had the camp of Israel, or you have the city of Jerusalem, and then you have outside. Under the old covenant, Jerusalem, or the camp in the wilderness, was holy, and outside was unholy, as a place of shame. Where you throw your trash, burn carcasses, execute criminals. But when Jesus came, because he came with a new covenant sacrifice, he died out here. He suffered out here, the writer tells us. And so what he did is he turned the cross, which if you think about history and think about the cross, you remember that the cross was a shameful thing. I mean, even the Old Testament said that cursed is he who hangs on a tree. Jesus would be accursed for us. That was a shameful thing. That was one of the most shameful ways to die. Not just painful, but shameful. His people rejected him and God's curses on him when he was lifted up onto the cross. And so Jesus took some, because Jesus died on that cross, an object and a place of shame became the holy place. And when he died on the cross, outside, the old inside, like those carcasses, was no longer useful. Its usefulness had expired. And so God had no problem destroying it later. Jesus took place of shame and made it a holy place, and he took a holy place and rendered it useless because it had served its purpose. It was a good and holy thing, but it was done. Jesus moved the holy place from the tabernacle to the cross. And our writer also tells us that Jesus didn't die in vain. He had a great eternal purpose in that. Verse 12, Jesus also that with the purpose that he might sanctify the people through his own blood. He was to sanctify them. He was to set them apart. By dying for his people, he set them apart to God. As priests who will serve God. And so he sets us apart. He sanctifies us. He makes us holy, set apart unto God. Think about those, you know, the idea that we've been working with of you got insiders and then outsiders. And the outsiders look in, you know, wishing they could be part of the inside group. Wanting to fit in, to belong, to be at home somewhere. Well, God is going to do is he's going to set all things right. And he already began that on the cross. And think about this. Okay, let's play with an earthly illustration and might maybe kind of help us to grasp this. Let's say that, picture yourself, whether you want to go back to when you're a kid or maybe even now. Think about, you know, when you're at work and there's this group of people at work that, you know, it's the in crowd. And or maybe it's at the supermarket where some of the ladies you know that come and you see them and they're having their little, you know, good old time talking and stuff and you're left out. Or maybe it's in your neighborhood. Maybe it's at school. Maybe it's at a homeschool event that we're having fellowship. And whatever it might be, think about, picture yourself being on the outside looking in. And let's say that for just a minute that one of those people wants to make sure that you recognize that you are an outsider. And they can tell that you want to be considered insider, that you want to be included. And so they go and they ostracize you, they reproach you, they're hateful to you. And as that's going on, and you're feeling horrible. And as that's happening, some terrorist comes and blows everything up, or someone comes in and shoots everybody. You know, that's happening more and more, okay? Well, in a few minutes you find yourself in heaven. You were an outsider here on earth. But as a believer in Jesus Christ, now all of a sudden in heaven you're an insider. And that's the only place that really matters. Because the only person whose opinion matters at all, and it'll be this way forever and ever, is God's. And you know, as a believer in Jesus Christ, what's going to happen. You know what the Lord is going to say to you. If you are a believer, well done, good and faithful servant. You're going to hear those words of acceptance, of love, of belonging, of I'm home. And then fast forward to Judgment Day. Now all humanity is going to be there around the throne of God, including that person who was ostracizing you and reproaching you. Except Jesus, he's separating people. And over here, the group you're in are his sheep. And that person who ostracized you are over here with the ones Jesus calls the goats. And now, as he says, you know, you all enter into the joy of your master. You're going to be able to hold your head up high, right? Because now the only group that even matters at all is the company of God's people. That's the ultimate eternal inside group, if you will. And what's unique about it is everybody is welcome to that group. You just have to come by faith. It's not like earthly insider groups where, you know, you have to be, you know, welcomed in by them, like, you know, special. It's like, well, no, we're not letting you, but okay, you can be. God's group, everybody is welcome to it. And so those who ostracized you look and see that you're in the real inside group, if you will. All of humanity will behold that. And all of humanity will behold the fact that, depart from me, all of you over here. That's the ultimate being on the outside. The ultimate rejection. This is the ultimate belonging, the ultimate acceptance. God will set all things right. But in order for this group to be accepted, the writer reminds us that the people of God must be sanctified. And he says, through his own blood. When Jesus went to make that new covenant sacrifice, that one new covenant sacrifice, he didn't bring, you know, a lamb with him, or a goat, or a bull to the cross. He brought himself, and he, through his own blood, he didn't have to bring a victim, some other victim, like all the old covenant sacrifices. He brought himself, and he offered himself there on that altar on the cross. And it was through his own blood that we are set apart. And it is from that cross that we as priests, from that altar that we eat. Because it was too shameful what happened to Jesus for it to happen in the old covenant holy place, he had to suffer outside the gate. He was sent outside because he was formally rejected by the Jews, by his own people. And so he was cast out, led out, and suffered outside the gate. And what's amazing, Jesus suffered outside the gate and became himself the gate, right? He is the way to God. That's just, you know, amazing to me. To think about the plan of God, how all that works. For him to go outside of this gate, to be rejected, to suffer shame, and then to become the gate, the way, the life, the way to God. So number two, let us go out to him and share his reproach. Verse 13, let us go out to him and share his reproach. Look there with me again. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp bearing his reproach. So the author, talking about those carcasses that we burned outside the gate, identifies the outside place as where Jesus would suffer. And so he says, let us go out to him. And think about how he's emphasizing that. Let us go out to him outside. Notice out. Not here in Judaism and all these other religious ideas, but outside. This is the nature of the new covenant. Jesus is outside the camp of non-biblical and extra-biblical religion. He's outside the camp of those. And so the author says, let us go outside to him. We might be pulled by old traditional liturgical whatever, those old ideas, and we might be pulled in another direction by all these new ideas. And we need to remember that we need to go outside of all of that to Jesus. Just as Jesus was totally rejected, so Jesus calls us to total separation from any other religion. We're called to exercise our priestly duties outside the camp, not within those religions, those religious ideas. And we're to do it bearing his reproach. We're supposed to carry his reproach with us. Paul made a big deal out of that for himself. Guys, I want you to understand, I'm always carrying around, you know, the reproach of Christ. And he calls us, the writer calls us to do the same thing, to carry it with us. So people say, oh, you go to that church? We have 5,000 people in our church. How big are you? Y'all don't have a rock band? Oh, sorry. I love rock bands, but not in church, you know? It distracts us from the worship of God. You see, it would have been hard for these readers, being Jews who are now saved, to have to face their Jewish, their unbelieving Jewish friends. Oh, you're following that guy that died in a place of shame? Cursed of God is your leader. He died a shameful death. Tell me again, how did he die? A cross. Yeah, that's like the worst place. It's a place for criminals. Oh, and it was inside the camp, right? He died in the temple, right? Oh no, he died out there where we burn carcasses. It is under that reproach that Jesus calls us to carry out our priestly duties. We're going to talk about those next time. He's going to mention two sacrifices that we do as priests in order to do them bearing his reproach. How do we do that? Well, when we go out to minister, we need to do so vulnerably. Think about when you serve, you will be reproached if you serve according to Jesus' way. Jesus promised, you know, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. Don't think that you're going to get by without that. They're going to reproach you. When you do good deeds to people, sometimes within the church and then sometimes people outside the church, and you do good deeds, they're not going to appreciate them. They may even ostracize you for it. They may disdain you. I mean, do you ever do something kind to somebody and they're like, or they say something hateful to you? What about when he talks about the sacrifice of praise? A lot of people think that we're doing it all wrong, and they let us know. You know, it's amazing, you know, when you talk to people, they talk about their church, and they go on and on and on, basically telling you how bad your church is without saying that. You know, it's like, okay, we do this. Do y'all do that? I'm serious. I mean, I've sat there and heard people do that, you know. But we have to be vulnerable, just like Jesus, the lamb led to the slaughter, and just keep worshiping him the way he called us to worship him, and to serve him, doing good, regardless of how people treat us, knowing that they will reproach us. See, the greatest display of God's love was when, or where, however you want to say it, the cross. And the greatest reproach that ever happened was where? Cross. You see how those go together? That's how God displays his love. Because when those that he's dying for reject him, he comes to die for them, and they're happy to help him. Help him die. Yeah, here, give me the nail and hammer. That's us. And he died for us. He showed us his love. He showed us his heart on the cross. Because his love is not like any earthly love. His love is a love that chooses to love regardless of the loveliness of the one loved. He doesn't look and say, okay, well, you know, you're a pretty good person. I'll die for you. I'll love you. No. Every one of us are, you know, completely unworthy of love. Completely unlovely. And that's how we see the beauty of his love, the greatness of God, the greatness of his character, is that he died for those who were unlovely. He chose to love us even when we were still his enemies. And so that same love is now displayed through his priests, us. We're to love in that same way. We're to be vulnerable in love, knowing that we may get reproached for it and hated for it and persecuted for it. I mean, think about it. You know, Christians have done good. There's been some bad things that people in the name of Christ have done. But by and large, Christians have done wonderful things. And how do we get treated typically? Wow, y'all are the most amazing people in the world. I don't want to be one of you, but y'all are great. You do so much good. You build hospitals and orphanages and do all these kind of wonderful things. And no, we do good and they just want to kill us. You know, it's amazing. But that's how it was for him, and that's how it'll be for us. And now finally, number three, set your sights on the future New Covenant city. Verse 14, set your sights on the future New Covenant city. He says there, for here on this earth we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. This is the encouragement we need, because he just told us, okay, you're going to have to bear his reproach. I want you to carry on your shoulders Jesus' reproach wherever you go and as you serve. We're like, oh, that doesn't sound like fun. He says, but keep in mind, while you're reproached here, while you're on the outside here, here isn't what it's all about. We're not looking for a city here. We're like Abraham. We're looking for that city which is to come. We don't have any stake in a city here. We're not going to find security here on the earth in some city. You know, we've got nice walls and nice defense systems and all this kind of... No, what we're looking for is a different city. But it doesn't mean that we're just wandering around aimlessly toward nothing. We are headed toward a city, but it's not an earthly city. It's the city to come. And he says that we continually seek for this. We deploy our will and our desire, and so we strive for this. We're not just kind of like, you know, hey, yeah, if I stumble across it, great, you know. No, we're looking for that city. We're constantly looking, striving toward that city, the one that is to come. It's the city, it's the city of all cities. It's the city, Revelation 21, that will be coming down from heaven. It's the new Jerusalem. That's the one we look for. It's the one that has the character of heaven. And it will come down to earth. And here on the new earth, that is our city. That's the one we're looking for. In that city, we'll finally be home. I mean, you know how after a while, you know, you may go out and eat and then you go home. And it's nice to get home. But when we're in that city, it's going to be home like we've never even understood. That's where we'll have the fullness of rest and peace and know that we are fully accepted. For it to really finally click for us that we are so accepted, we are as accepted to God the Father as is His Son, accepted by the Father. Loved with the same love that He loves with which He loves His Son. Talk about an in-group, right? That's going to be us on the inside. And that home has been earned for us based on what His Son accomplished on the cross. And it is on that altar, the cross, that we feed by faith daily. That city is going to be the end of the journey for us, where we're finally home forever. We'll finally be accepted. We'll finally belong. Here we're ambassadors. This isn't our country. We're looking for this country to come, the city to come. And I want to ask each of us, do we have our sights on that city? Do you have your sights set on that city? I hope so. Let us set sights on it.